Hello, my name is Omar Haredi, and today the topic that we'll be discussing is civility in the era of automation and paraprofessionals. What I intend to cover today is some basic foundational information about civility and its importance. We'll then move into our subtopics, or our focus for this talk, which is automation and paraprofessionals and paralegals. And then finally, we're going to close up and round out with some potential solutions as to how we could potentially address civility in light of the challenges that we've identified. To start out, we really can't have any discussion today in Ontario or even anywhere in Canada about civility in the legal profession without mentioning Joseph Greuel. And in an article on October 21st, 2016 article of the Toronto Star, it stated, as Joe Breuer put it, people don't hire a lawyer because they're nice and polite. Clients hire lawyers because they believe the lawyer is all that stands between them and disaster. With all due respect, I happen to disagree with Joseph Breuer. I believe that clients hire lawyers because we have a job to do, and that job is conflict resolution. And if incivility prevents a lawyer from doing their job, then that should not be the basis for hiring a lawyer. And in fact, it should be a basis for a client to not choose a lawyer. So that's sort of where I'm going to be going to this. Let's start out first, though, with why incivility matters. The first reason why it matters is because it's less effective for the client. The more uncivil a lawyer is, the more time, the more money, the more unnecessary steps are taken in a proceedings, all of which is charged usually on a billable rate to the client, and very little is accomplished. In other words, incivility under the guise of applying pressure or negotiation tactics really just doesn't accomplish the goal. It often antagonizes the other side. So in applying these pressure tactics and acting unruly, the other side often then digs in their heels, puts their back up against the wall, and prevents even further exploration of settlement or conflict resolution. And then finally, and perhaps the most important reason why civility matters, and the reason why we continue to hear so much about it in CPD programs and throughout our bar, throughout our profession, is because incivility costs our courts money. Our publicly funded legal system, the courthouse that are funded by our tax dollars, the judges that are paid by our tax dollars, and all the court staff, are inappropriately used when we have to draw on proceedings or draw out proceedings unnecessarily or introduce delays or unnecessary steps simply because of the antagonistic conduct of counsel. So in a nutshell, it doesn't work. The question that many of us ask, and what we continue to ask, is why does it still happen if we know that incivility is ineffective and it doesn't work? And I think the short answer to that is that clients don't necessarily know that it doesn't work and that it's ineffective, and then it ultimately costs them a lot of money. It may also be in part because we as lawyers have forgotten who it is, who it is that we are and what our profession is supposed to stand for. And so I'd like to quote Beverly Smith in an article about a lawyer's duty to opposing counsel, which says, to the extent to which lawyers have lost our sense of professionalism is precisely the extent to which we have lost our focus on our duties to others and on serving their best interests, and not, coincidentally, to the meaning and satisfaction of our vocations as lawyers. The less we dwell on others and the more we serve ourselves, the weaker do our bonds of professionalism become. And for this reason, we're going to be dwelling a little bit on the rules of professional conduct and thinking about how we can serve, ultimately, our clients, but also serve the justice system, a duty which still overrides our duty to our clients when we're examining the conduct of a lawyer on a file. Let's move back to the Joseph Greuel decision. Okay, the reason why everybody is talking about Joseph Greuel is because this was the major case of incivility, as a recap, that where an individual, highly regarded individual in the bar, who has subsequently become a bencher, was disciplined by the Law Society for incivility on a very high-profile case. He managed to appeal it unsuccessfully to the Divisional Court, and appealed it again to the Court of Appeal. And that leave, and he's subsequently appealed as well to the Supreme Court of Canada, and that leave is pending. So this is probably the most high-profile incivility case that we have in Canada, and it's worthy of further examination. If we look at the Ontario Court of Appeal decision specifically, Justice Kronk affirmed the divisional court decision, which we'll talk about in a second, and at paragraphs 94 and 95, emphasized that the lawyer's duty of commitment to the client's cause does not overwhelm or reduce in any way the breach of the professional obligations of courtesy, civility, and good faith. In particular, the Court of Appeal was reviewing new case law. So there was the decision by the Supreme Court of Canada in the Federation of Law Societies explaining what the lawyer's duty, if you will, was to the client. Mr. Groya attempted to rely on this case to say that the Law Society as a state actor shouldn't be able to impose any duties on him that would interfere with his duty to act in what he perceived to be his client's best interests or promoting his client's cause. The Court of Appeal obviously rejected that argument and didn't adopt that interpretation of the case, and instead said that this is quite a reasonable explanation, especially in light of the role and the function that the Law Society plays in administrative law. Further on in the decision, the Court of Appeal emphasized at paragraph 241 that it is our professionalism that actually secures the nobility of our what we do. So some very, very strong wording there from the Court of Appeal. But the Court of Appeal didn't really emphasize or spell out what the test for civility is. That was done by the divisional court, and we anticipate, and perhaps, the Supreme Court of Canada will either further carve that out or revise that further, or even affirm what the divisional court had stated. So let's look at what the divisional court had actually said about incivility. Justice Nordheimer, who wrote for the unanimous court, indicated at paragraphs 48 to 50 that it's relatively easy to create rules around incivility, and so that's what law societies do. But applying these rules practically to the conduct of lawyers in the profession ultimately becomes much more challenging. Therefore, on that basis, at paragraph 68, he said that incivility does not allow for a fixed definition. We understand that it's difficult to actually understand and define what incivility is, and also said in paragraph 72 that the Law Society Appeal Panel that actually reviewed the initial discipline didn't go far enough in actually defining what incivility is. So the divisional court helped us out a little bit. At paragraph 73 and 74, they explained that the conduct must be uncivil, obviously, which means more than just zealous advocacy. They provided discrete examples of what this might actually be. For example, behavior that was rude, unnecessarily abrasive, sarcastic, demeaning, abusive, or of any like quality to those types of behaviors. They went on, though, and they said that incivility can also include attacks of the personal integrity of opponents, the parties, the witnesses, or of the court, if it's done without good faith. So it's not just the nature of the behavior or how a lawyer is conducting himself or herself on a file, it's also to who that conduct is directed towards, which really ultimately in this definition in paragraph 73 and 74 involves everybody to who the lawyer is potentially dealing with in the conduct of their practice. They also emphasize that repeated conduct is more likely to meet that standard of misconduct than a single instance, unless that single instance is particularly egregious. So that's something to keep in mind. For today's talk, having given that outline and an overview of civility as we currently understand it in the case law, we're going to focus on two special subsets and go through some rules of professional conduct and see how they apply. In particular, we're going to examine some of the technological shifts in the legal industry, and then we're going to look at the rise of paraprofessionals and paralegals. Let's define each of those first before we proceed. The technological shifts is something that we've been seeing obviously for years and years and years, with a move to more digitization, more automation, more computers, more technology. It's a wonderful thing in my mind, something that we'll speak to later on when we discuss the rules. But one of the challenges that emerges is that we often have less face-to-face interaction as colleagues. It may be common sense, if you think about it, that you're less likely to be civil to someone who you've never met, who you've never seen in person, who you've never actually had a personal connection with. And in fact, we see this from other studies, generally, where social scientists look at the behavior of individuals online. The reason why there is trolling and harassment that occurs online, on Twitter or other platforms, is based on a phenomenon called the online disinhibition effect. In other words, when you're online, or for our purposes, behind a computer screen, you're far more likely to be a keyboard warrior and be far more aggressive about the way that you conduct yourself. And so that is one of the major significant shifts that we're seeing simply through the introduction of technology, where we don't have as much of a collegial bar. We're not, as the profession used to do, interacting with each other on as regular a basis, and the majority of our communications are now electronic. I'll put this slightly differently. It's much more difficult to be really, really mean and nasty when you're looking someone in the eye, and you see that look of hurt or that look of disappointment in their face. At the end of the day, all of us have even an ounce of empathy, even if it's very, very, very deep down. And so we react to the fact that individuals are reacting negatively when we mistreat them or treat them inappropriately. And that's the online disinhibition effect. On the other side of the spectrum, we also are seeing a cultural shift. Along the same lines, we're seeing with the iPhone and the SMS generation, a whole generation of younger lawyers who have spent the majority of their social interactions, if you will, either online or through technological interfaces. For them, this untowards behavior is a norm. That's what they've grown up around. Perhaps they have a thicker skin around it. It still does not make it appropriate. And that's going to be part of the challenge that they're going to have to deal with, is understanding what the cultural norms are for our profession and what type of conduct is appropriate and what type of conduct is not. Sometimes that will be learned slowly over time, and other times it may require quite a bit of assistance. And that leads to my third point, to the third technological shift, is that we have a greater reliance on technology generally. And so that means that we don't have to necessarily work with other staff members in our practice. We don't have to interact with other people as much as we used to in the past. And so, along the same lines as my first point, we just have a lot less interaction with human beings in the legal context, but also a lot less hands-on training. The very old traditional model of legal training, where you would follow another practitioner day in, day out, to the office, to court, back to the office, to their actual room in the office, where you observe them firsthand, is not the type of model what we see with training today, whether it's articling or the LPP program, or even for junior associates. And so there is a challenge there in understanding, again, what the appropriate means is to actually communicate. The second major subtopic that we're going to explore when looking at the rules is what we've phrased here as the rise of paraprofessionals. The reason for this is because lawyers are largely costed out of the market entirely for the majority of the public. This is what we also refer to as the access to justice issue. The majority of client work these days is already done by support staff. It's not typically done first-hand by the lawyer. And that support staff may not be as adept or as attuned to the professional requirements to be civil on a file. In other words, the incivility may actually arise from a letter or correspondence or pleadings that are crafted or drafted by non-lawyers, or otherwise aggravated by non-lawyers. So this is what we mean by paraprofessionals, individuals who are assisting the professional lawyers. We also have the introduction of licensed paralegals here in Ontario, and I think it's important to distinguish this. The licensed paralegals are not themselves paraprofessionals. They are professionals in their own right, but the reason why it becomes an issue for professionalism and for civility is because the fact that the paralegal profession is new in our jurisdiction means that for many lawyers, they still treat paralegals as if they're non-lawyers, and as if they should be treated with less respect than their professional colleagues. Again, I will contest the fact that that should be done. In fact, part of what we will be focusing on is that professional conduct should be demonstrated not only to other lawyers and other counsel on the other side, or paralegals for that matter, but also self-represented parties who cannot afford a lawyer and a paralegal. Okay, so there is a professionalism that comes into play, even where the other party does not have that duty. And the way that we can understand this is, especially where we're dealing with a self-represented party who does not have that duty, is that this is an honorable profession. Okay, and we find authority for that under Rule 2.1 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, where the duty to carry on practice with honor and integrity is spelled out. We also have a duty there to uphold the standards, but also the reputation of the profession. In other words, if a self-represented party on the other side is behaving in an unreasonable manner and acting rude and abrasive, that's really more of a reflection of them as an individual. If we are to respond in kind in the same way, that becomes not just a reflection of us as an individual, but also a reflection of us as a profession. And so we have a higher standard to maintain. It is a higher burden that we have to maintain, but it also comes in part because we understand that we play a special role within the legal system. To further understand what our role is within that legal system, we can look at Rule 5.1, which discusses the role of the lawyer as an advocate. This rule says that the lawyer should act as an advocate in a manner which requires candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. And so in every circumstance and in every situation, it requires that we actually still emphasize those principles of candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect in every single instance. The next rules that I will look at, or next concept that I'll look at under the rules, is to explore what it means to be a good lawyer. If you recall, I started out by saying that many clients perhaps perceive that a better lawyer or a good lawyer or a more effective lawyer is one who is aggressive, one who is very, very, very assertive, perhaps even to the extent where they are rude and abrasive and pushing up to that line of incivility and perhaps even crossing beyond it. That might be the perception that many members of the public have, which leads into part of the challenge why we have incivility to begin with. Rule 3.1 defines good in a slightly different way, and granted the rule actually defines competence. Competence includes under this rule the relevant knowledge, skills, and attributes that are relevant to practice. Well, there's a lot of knowledge, skills, and attributes that are relevant to practice, and part of that is communication skills, and it's being able to maintain your calm even under pressure, and being able to respond in an appropriate manner even when the party responding to you is not behaving in that manner. When we tie this into the technological issues, does this also relate to technological competence? Should we be not only competent with the use of our technology or new and emerging technology and incorporate that into our practice? And this is something that we're seeing more and more and more, where some lawyers are not actually keeping up with technological changes and, you know, the emerging trends. And so under this rule, some interpretation of it would actually suggest that part of our requirement to be competent is not just to stay abreast of the substantive law or to explore the rules of professional conduct as we are today, but also to keep track of those technological trends. What about those paraprofessionals? Again, we're not talking about paralegals yet. What about the competence of those who are under our direction, like support staff, law clerks, legal assistants, and the like? Well, Rule 6.1 makes it quite clear that we actually still have to impress on anybody who is working under our direction that the rules of professional conduct, through extension, also apply to them. In other words, it's not a sufficient excuse to say, well, I wasn't uncivil. I wasn't the one who was rude or abrasive. We never spoke. I didn't pick up the phone. We didn't speak face to face. All you received was a letter from my office. Now, granted, that letter from my office may have had my name on the bottom and had my signature, but I'm not the one who drafted it. That was my support staff. I'm sorry, I apologize, but I'm not really responsible for that. Rule 6.1 would say otherwise. We are responsible, in fact, for the conduct of those who operate underneath our direction. And so it is appropriate, and it's actually quite necessary, to review the work that they do to ensure, especially in this context, that the conduct that is underway is actually still appropriate. Moving on to paralegals, how do we deal with paralegals? Well, there's an advantage here, I believe, that distinguishes paralegals from parties who are self-represented and who are not bound by the rules of professional conduct. And that advantage is that the paralegals in this jurisdiction have their own paralegal rules of conduct, and under 3.01, they also have a requirement to be competent. The question is, does that definition of competence mean the same level of competence as lawyers? And many lawyers, this is a source of contention, and it's an issue, and it's an area of friction, where on a file, they may feel, you know, given the greater number of years of education, perhaps even the greater number of years of practicing law than a paralegal who's in the industry, that they know more and they know better, and they're frustrated that the paralegal who is a licensee and licensed by the law society does not. Well, the response to that is still to be civil and still not to get frustrated, as I think you might intuit. But it's also, we have to understand to a certain extent, that based on at least one case that we have, Queen and Belinsky, I believe it's paragraph 66 where the authority for that is found, that paralegals are held to a different standard and a different level of competence. So how do we deal with a file where we feel as if the paralegal on the other side doesn't know the requisite law enough and that's aggravating either ourselves or our client? Well, we still deal with it in a professional manner. The advantage of the new summary judgment case law that's emerging after the Herniak and Bassin decision has led way to quicker and more expeditious manners to resolve disputes where there is actually quite clear-cut case law. So in other words, if there is these types of issues, I believe that there are mechanisms that we're introducing and probably more mechanisms that we'll introduce that will allow us to scale back the inappropriate use of certain pleadings or certain claims or misunderstandings, if you will, of the law. So we have those mechanisms there, and that is what we mean by zealous advocacy. Zealous advocacy is using your knowledge of the law, so it's an intellectual response, to respond to perhaps either uncivil conduct or positions within litigation that are unsustainable. We have another challenge, though, under this definition of competence. And this other challenge is that paralegals, as it currently stands in this jurisdiction, have a limited scope of practice, as they probably should, but that limited scope of practice is potentially being expanded. It's being challenged regularly, and they're pushing for, many of them, I should say, are pushing for an expanded scope of practice. And some of the areas that we may see them entering into in the future is greater responsibilities within the area of immigration law, or even more contentiously within the area of family law. And so now we have new entrants into the market or into segments of the legal market who may or may not have formal training in this background. Because these changes haven't been made, we don't actually know what those requirements would be. I think if those changes were made, it would be astute to actually require some formal training in that respect. But potentially we're dealing with a challenge where these individuals are now getting to new areas of law and once again may not be as adept with the substantive area of law in those areas. It doesn't necessarily mean we're lowering the quality of law by doing so, but we should understand that there is a different level of competence that's expected of paralegals and lawyers, and also that we are allowed to use our more extensive knowledge through the substantive mechanisms, through the procedural mechanisms that are available in law to advance the interests of our client without necessarily having to resort to disparaging comments or negative behavior or conduct towards other legal professionals. A lot of what we're talking about here really has to do with how do we deal with what I'm going to term internal and external stakeholders. And so who are our internal stakeholders when it comes to a legal practice? Usually when we talk about internal stakeholders, we're going to be talking about our clients. I mean, it also includes our staff and colleagues and coworkers that we work with. And rule 3.2 is the rule where we find the quality of service is defined. And so quality of service means that we should provide courteous services through promptly replying to our clients. And we know from LawPro that one of the main reasons why clients complain to the Law Society or sue lawyers is because of communication issues. Quality is further defined to include timely and efficient and civil conduct. So in other words, behaving in a civil way is directly related to how we provide quality service to our internal stakeholders. I want to briefly touch on the timeliness and the efficiency. And if we are using technology properly, in my opinion, we can actually be more timely and more efficient in the way that we do things. In fact, it's one of the downsides of technology is that we're constantly tethered to our practice. From the interpretation of the perspective of the rules, it also means that where the appropriate circumstances are appropriate, we can also be far more effective in responding in a timely manner to our clients. We also have responsibilities to external stakeholders, and we've talked about that responsibility to the course, but I want to shift a little bit here now to Rule 7.2, which provides a responsibility to lawyers and to others. In other words, we must be courteous, civil, and behave in good faith to all persons that we have dealings with in the course of our practice. That's very broad. Okay, so that includes the registrar, it includes the self-represented party, it also includes the paralegal, and includes every other person that we come about in our professional life. That's quite a broad understanding of what it means, and so I think this is part of the point, is that we want to address incivility not only because of its effect on the court system and on the other parties, nobody likes dealing with an uncivil lawyer, but think about what it's like to have to work with an uncivil lawyer. My assumption is that if you are rude and abrasive and obnoxious when you're working on a file, and that's the way you behave generally with all the other lawyers on the other side of a file, you probably have, I would expect, some difficulty shutting that off. Shutting that off when you go home, shutting that off when you go to work and you're dealing with your colleagues and support staff and everyone else that you may come across in the course of your professional duties. I'm not sure that I would want to work with someone that conducts themselves in that way. I think it also detracts from the nature of our profession. It actually affects our work-life balance. It affects our satisfaction with our profession and with our job, and affects the mental health of the other licensees, the other lawyers and paralegals we are working with. So that's not really what we're trying to do. And it's another angle of this whole civility discussion or this debate that we should keep in mind, especially when we're talking about the other parties that may be involved. The next focus or the next topic I'm going to touch on is what I'm going to call the access to justice issue, the access to justice crisis. And in particular, I'm going to point to Rule 4.1. Rule 4.1 talks about making legal services available. Legal services should be made available under this rule in an efficient and a convenient way. And I've touched on this already about how technology can actually make and enhance the practice and can be more efficient and effective. But we should also understand the limitations that our profession provides us to better understand the role of other players and the tools that they provide. In other words, if we believe that we can do everything by ourselves, by hand, writing it out ourselves, not resorting on, I'll use actually a better example than that, if we believe that the best way to do research in today's day and era is to start out with going down to the great library, going to the actual physical stacks of the books, running your fingers along the DLRs, okay, and trying to find a physical copy of a case, that's not an effective and efficient way to find a case. I mean, there is a place, obviously, for those types of resources, but it's not your first step, and you're not actually using the tools, the technology that is available to you. We are in an exciting time in the profession where we're starting to see more and more automation, artificial intelligence, and other types of legal tools that are developing, which actually do allow for us to provide, as I've said, more timely, more efficient services, but also more cost-effective services, which allows us to serve a broader segment of society. And so this component of technology is directly related to our duty to make legal services as broadly available as we can. The use of other staff, and this goes for support staff, but also the use of paralegals, other licensed professionals, within this system allows for the public to actually receive services in a different way, or in a more effective way, in a more cost-effective way. We've talked about how support staff, if they are actually producing information under your direction, those rules of professional conduct should still be imparted upon them. That's something that they still have to uphold under your supervision. And the paralegals have their own rules that they have to observe as well. By realizing this, we understand not only our own role within the legal system, but also the role of all the other parties and the place that they play. In other words, going back to that frustration that I suggested that a lawyer may encounter when dealing with a self-represented party or with a paralegal, if they understand that the majority of self-represented parties that we know from studies are not self-represented by choice. They are self-represented because they simply cannot afford it. They would love to have a lawyer or a paralegal representing them, but they cannot afford those services. That creates or introduces an element of empathy, hopefully, and we understand that this person is probably feeling lost and confused and doesn't really understand what's going on in the legal system around them, and sometimes their conduct or their behavior is a defense mechanism against that. And if we interpret that behavior simply being a defense mechanism, a way that a person is lashing out against fear and insecurity about a system they don't understand, it allows us to center ourselves and to think about it for a second in terms of how we respond appropriately. These concepts also relate to Rule 5.6, which talks about the lawyer and the administration of justice. We actually have a duty to encourage the public respect for and improve the administration of justice. When we behave in an uncivil manner, when we draw out proceedings, when we are on the front page of national newspapers or significant newspapers because of our conduct on a file, in my opinion, that's not actually advancing the public perception of the administration of justice. It's only feeding into a misconception or a perception of what a lawyer is or what our profession should be. And as we've already indicated, we have a very different understanding of what this profession should be, which is an honorable profession which is intended to serve the public. So in this last component, after canvassing these rules, the last component I'm going to be moving towards is how do we actually respond to incivility when we deal with it in light of the contemporary challenges that I've identified, but also more generally. The first strategy that I'm going to mention is that we should put everything in writing. And I mean absolutely everything in writing. So what that means is you receive a phone call from the other side. You don't take the phone call. To the extent that you do take the phone call, you say, you know what, that's fine. Please put this in writing. You do not respond. Responding to someone who's behaving in a rude, abrasive, obnoxious manner only feeds into their need for conflict. So you step away and you disengage. By putting everything in writing, it allows you to slow it down. It allows you to take control of your own feelings. But most importantly, and I think this is going to tie into one of the final solutions or suggestions that I have, it provides a written record. And the written record, as we've seen, is actually absolutely essential. The Groya case only went to the Law Society because his incivility or the conduct in question happened at trial, and it was through the transcript of that trial that the Law Society reviewed the majority of his conduct. When we're dealing with incivility in the bar, a significant portion of it happens in phone calls, and we're not allowed to record phone calls with another licensee. It happens in hallways. It happens outside courtrooms. It happens in correspondence between lawyers, which are never actually introduced into the court record. But if we do keep a record of it, and we do actually use this record as a tool to battle incivility, it can be a significant instrument in being able to push back. Having everything in writing also allows you to not respond immediately. As much as I talked about technology, and I said that it gives us the ability to respond in a more timely way, slowing it down is itself a way of taking control of a situation that is already out of control because of the conduct of the other party. So you do this for your own sake because it prevents you from behaving inappropriately, but also for your own client's sake because responding in kind is not going to help anybody. This next point is a little bit more challenging. It's probably going to be tougher for some counsel to swallow. When you're dealing with someone who's completely uncivil, in my opinion, you should refuse to compromise. It means you dig in your heels. you don't settle at that point in time. Primarily because the bad conduct should not promote good results. Now that means it's a little bit challenging. It means from the outset, you probably have to tell your client, look, we're dealing with a very, very difficult lawyer here who is going to make settlement quite challenging, but we understand that eventually, over time, by not feeding into their need for conflict or encouraging that type of behavior, they're going to realize that that's not getting them results, hopefully. And so either the lawyer themselves will change their conduct, and that's really what we're trying to get at with both law society discipline, or the other strategies that I'm going to suggest in the next few minutes, is to get them to reform their conduct. Or their client may clue in and decide that they may need different representation and a different approach to resolving their legal dispute. Ultimately, though, who can fight incivility? I think this is the point where I say that this is our joint responsibility in the bar. So this is our responsibility as the profession to actually address it as a whole. And a big part of what I'm going to talk about are actually the solutions outside of law society discipline. I think discipline is just a small component of it, and it is a clumsy instrument. Instead, what I'm going to touch on is how our responses to incivility, beyond what we've talked about here, can ensure that not only is it ineffective, but that the clients understand that it is ineffective. What we're trying to get at with this is that the uncivil lawyers should not be valued by their clients. And so how do we do that? Well, we start to build into our system disincentives for incivility. We know who the uncivil lawyers are. We learn who they are very, very quickly. It's usually the first thing that many of us do when we get an opening letter from a lawyer on the other side who we've never spoken to or heard from before. We ask around and we get a very good idea of what type of file this is going to be. And I think the first step is we stop referring to litigators, we refer to other lawyers as being tough. Tough is the type of adjective that seems to be a compliment. Instead, let's use more derogatory terms. This person is a bully. This person is unreasonable. This person is not going to work with you very well. We can describe those same characteristics in other ways when we refer to our colleagues, and that's actually quite fair to do. In other words, we're creating a little bit of social shunning. We can also introduce financial disincentives. The vast majority of legal files today, the vast majority of legal work, is still passed on through word of mouth. So reputation matters. And so what we start to do is not refer files to lawyers who behave in these types of ways, and we actually let clients know, or potential clients know, that that's not the kind of lawyer that they want or that they need. We're not doing enough of that yet, and I think we need to do a little bit more. We can also try to strengthen the reforms, and this is my last suggestion, to ensure greater accountability. The regulator may still have a role. The Broya case is going to the Supreme Court of Canada, and we'll have a better understanding of what the Supreme Court thinks about the role of the regulator and its ability to regulate conduct on files. But we do have other mechanisms, and perhaps we have to reconsider how we use those mechanisms. And so one suggestion, one that's currently under review, is to strengthen the cost consequences, not just for the client, but also for the lawyer. We've talked about summary judgments and the cost consequences for that. And cost consequences are, in our system, as opposed to the American system, one of the most significant elements to deter conduct. But we also have Rule 5707 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, and also Rule 249 of the Family Law Rules, which allows for costs to be awarded specifically against the lawyer. This is very rarely implemented. It's only the most egregious type of conduct where this falls under it. But in reviewing our rules, and the Family Law Rules Committee is actually currently reviewing the Family Law Rules for reform, and in particular, I've made a submission about Rule 249 in the conduct of a lawyer, that perhaps we need to say that the threshold for this type of cost consequences is lower than it has been in the past. What this would do is all of those correspondence, all of those solutions that I said about in terms of putting things in writing, making sure we have a record, slowing everything down, and not responding in kind will actually have a financial implication not only to the lawyer, but also to the industry as a whole, because as soon as we start doing that, there is now a disincentive generally in the society and in the legal community in terms of behaving in that way. In other words, a written decision, a written cost decision against a lawyer personally is probably one of the most damaging things that we can do in our profession for their reputation. And so that in itself will affect their business revenues, it'll affect their professional progression, and so either they will reform themselves and behave differently in order to succeed as a professional lawyer, or they will fall on that sword and not succeed at all. And I think that's a choice that is entirely up to them to make, but we do have the ability to provide those social pressures without using the blunt instrument of sanction or discipline by the law society. That's my overview of civility. I think it's a concept that and a topic that we're going to continue to be discussing, especially once the Supreme Court of Canada weighs in on this in the months and the years to come. And in particular, we touched on as a review technological changes, as well as paraprofessionals and paralegals and expanding scopes of practice, all issues that we're still going to see changes and developments in the months and years to come. So I think it's an interesting topic. It's an exciting topic. I do have some contact information there if you want to reach out to me, and I can send you further information or materials if you're so interested. Thank you very much for your attention.